is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford, and on this week's episode, we hear from Marilyn Heath with our judge's tip, and she's going to talk about how to maximize on your dressage test score. And then we'll hear from Dr. Duncan Peters in another of the series of Mythbusters, where he tackles some topical issues. But first, in the news this week, the USDF has announced the return of Scott Hassler and Ingo Papiff for the 2014 USDF Sport Horse Prospect Development Forum, presented by USDF education partner Dressage at Devon, that will be held October 4th and 5th at DG Bar Ranch in Hanford, California. This year's event will once again feature a live forum approach and provide a correct fundamental system for starting sport horse prospects. The program is intended for trainers, owners, and breeders nationwide, with the goal of developing a consistent training foundation for all sport horse prospects as they progress from in-hand to under-saddle and eventual competition. You can find out more about this forum at the website usdf.org. Now for our judge's tip. Marilyn Heath has been an S-judge since 1989. She rode in the 1986 World Championships and has achieved her USDF bronze, silver, and gold medals. Marilyn won the USDF Lifetime Achievement Award in 2013 and is a member of the L faculty, serving as their chair for 9 years. Marilyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thank you for presenting our judge's tip this week, because I think it's something that most riders will be pleased to hear about, how to maximize your dressage scores. And there are so many components to that, aren't there?
Yes, there are a lot of things to think about.
And I think, you know, one of the first things that comes to mind, of course, is whether people actually read the directives and the purpose of that test. Although, you know, there's a limit to how much one can write on the sheet, but there are directives to follow, aren't there?
There are, and it's essential that riders are aware of the purpose of each level and whether their horse is up to fulfilling the purpose of that level before they present themselves in the arena. And also, it's helpful for them to read the directives so that they have an idea of what the judge is paying attention to when they're in the arena. That doesn't mean that the directives are all-inclusive. We look at other things as well, but the directives are an important consideration.
And I think you want to start with some of the basics, don't you, such as, you know, the symmetry and the correct movements and that sort of thing.
Well, the basics are really what's included in the pyramid of training. When we judge, we consider the basics in each and every movement. And so one is considering whether the horse is in the correct rhythm for each gait, and whether the horse is relaxed and supple, and whether the horse is accepting the contact, whether the connection is complete from back to front, whether the horse has impulsion and straightness, and from second level up, whether the collection is there appropriate to the level. So the basics are considered in each movement of each test, so the basics are of utmost importance.
And the rider, of course, can influence the marks of each movement.
Absolutely. The rider it only gets the scores in the collective marks, but the rider is influencing each movement and influencing how correctly each movement is ridden.
Obviously, from the judge's box is the view that you take, so give us some idea of what that looks like from your perspective.
Well, the rider needs to consider what it looks like from the judge's box, whether it's C or as one gets into the regional finals and the U.S. finals. There are judges in other viewpoints, and it's important for the rider to put themselves into the eyes of the judge in whatever box the judge is sitting in. And the one very good way to get that perspective is to volunteer as a scribe or to go through the L program and see it from that perspective. It's important for the rider to understand that the judge is looking first at the basics and then at the criteria of each movement. And the criteria of each movement is discussed in the USEF rulebook in the dressage section. And riders should learn to use the USEF rulebook as their textbook, because that's where the criteria are spelled out for each movement.
Well, I was just wondering about symmetry and geometry. Are those two topics that you'd like to address?
Yes. Let's talk first about how the rider can impact the test results with their position. We'll get to the geometry. But first, the rider has to have a correct position in order for their aids to be effective. And then one can ride more correctly. And then you mentioned geometry. Accuracy is considered a modifier. We have an equation that we use when we're judging. The basics plus the criteria plus or minus the modifiers equal the final score. And the accuracy is one of those modifiers. Stumbling, shying, those things are also modifiers. But in order to ride a test accurately, one must understand the geometry of the arena. It's 20 meters wide, 60 meters long, and to ride a correct circle, for instance, is very important. It's not just a nitpicking thing. There is a purpose for riding a round circle, and if one puts flat spots in the circle, you're taking away from the benefit of that exercise. Also, with accuracy, if a circle is made larger than is called for in the directives of the test, that circle is then easier, and so you, by making the circle larger, one is taking away from the degree of difficulty of the circle. So if one learns to ride accurately from the beginning, from the intro level where geometry is mentioned in the collectives, and the rider test's geometry is also mentioned, if one learns to ride correctly and does it by habit, accuracy becomes a habit, then one can concentrate when one gets to a show in riding the horse instead of riding the test, and it makes for a smoother performance. Serpentines, then, are dependent on a correct 20-meter circle, because a serpentine, the width of the arena is three even 20-meter half circles. And if one is used to riding a circle from C, for instance, that is 20 meters wide and 18 meters deep, then the serpentine will be 18 meters, 24 meters, and 18 meters, and that's not a correct serpentine. So by learning to ride accurately at home, then one does not have to worry about that little detail when one gets to a show. And it should be a little detail, because as I started out by saying, accuracy is a modifier. Know the geometry of the arena. Practice riding corners correctly. Corners have just recently, in the last year or two, been mentioned in the USEF rulebook, and one needs to use that too as a reference. And the corners become deeper as one moves up the levels. And the corners are where we can hide a multitude of sins, so to speak. That's where the half halts are effective. That's where one sets up their horse for the next movement. So that becomes an important detail as well.
And do you want to just touch upon the entry, Marilyn? Because, of course, setting up the test and being balanced on your entry, that will set you up for the first few movements, won't it?
It does, and it provides the judge with their first impression as well. So it's important that the horse be on the center line. It's even more important that the horse be straight. The halt, then, at X, the judge from C cannot tell whether the halt is exactly at X, but when you get to regional or national finals, there will be a judge at the side, and then that is more obvious. So straightness on the center line, and the halt now is defined as being 3 seconds long, so the halt should not be rushed. And then it's important also, as the rider leaves X and makes the turn at C, that the rider does not let the horse drift in the opposite direction. They're horses, not trucks. They don't need wide turns.
Well, I think that covers some of the things that riders can look out for to try and improve their dressage marks. Marilyn, thank you very much indeed for joining us this week.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
And now for our final segment in the series of Mythbusters with Dr. Duncan Peters, that was taken from the education session held at the 2013 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. Dr. Peters begins by addressing the use of shockwave on performance horses.
The comment was that some of the racetracks were actually banning the use of shockwave, and that's in fact true. And part of that is because of the analgesic effect of what happens with nerves and pain response. And the shockwave is used a lot for tendon, ligaments, and bony injuries, and now being used for muscle-type soreness also, and some of the pain associated with that. But it's a pulse, acoustic wave, sound waves, that release energy as they go through different tissue densities. Well, it affects nerves also, but it also stimulates the physiologic activity of healing tissues, and that's why it's used in terms of that. But some research at LSU looked specifically at some nerves, and primarily because of analgesia being caused. And it really came to light with some horses that fractured on the racetrack, that had a mild lameness, went out, and then had a catastrophic fracture. And in retrospect, those horses had stress fractures or incomplete, microfractures at that time, used a shockwave on them, decreased the nerve pain response, and those horses went out to perform just fine, but ended up fracturing the leg. So that's really where it came from. We see those stress fractures also. I mean, we see them in sport horses and mature adult sport horses too. But what was happening was that these horses, they'd have a mild lameness, they'd treat them, and then they'd go out and run them. They'd be in training, coming up toward a race, get a little bit sore. Oh, we've got some sore feet, or it's a little sore through the pastern area. They'd shockwave it, and then these horses would fracture their pastern or their ankle. So that's where basically this research came from. But they looked at the sensory nerve conduction velocities of these nerves on the lower legs at 3, 7, and 35 days after treatment. And then they compared it to the opposite foot of the same animal for its own control, per se. And the results showed that even up to 35 days, there was a significant delay in the nerve conduction. So the ability of that nerve to give it input back to the body. Well, pain is a great deterrent. If you're hurting, you don't want to go do something. I think we all can recognize that. That is one of our mechanisms to back off. Well, they actually found also that they could get analgesia or numbness that could last for a couple of days. And so that's why a lot of the rules and regulations now are no treatment within 5 days of competition. So the USDF is looking at a rule right now. I'm on the veterinary committee as well as the drugs and medication committee, and that's one of the rules that is probably going to be in there. But it points out the concern that we don't want horses competing with numbness, and there's also a need for an accurate diagnosis of the condition. That may involve more than just saying, well, we're going to treat that. Maybe we need to know what it is, before we ask this horse to go back on the playing field. And we worry about those injuries, catastrophic injuries especially. And as I said, the FEI, no sooner than 5 days, it's in their regs, and the USEF, it'll be in there quickly, within the next year. It can be very effective. It's based on lithotripsy in people, vibrations within the tissues, break up bladder stones and things like kidney stones. And in horses, we use it in damaged tissue and stimulates blood flow, has a bunch of cytokine inflammatory, anti-inflammatory reactions, stimulates growth factors. So there's a lot of work that's been done, both in bone and in soft tissue, that does show its beneficial effects. So it is a very effective therapy used for different things and at different times. It should be really used under a whole program of rehab and repair, basically, rather than a program of trying to get a horse back into competition quickly, that type of thing.
In the next segment, Dr. Peters addresses the challenges of keeping your horse fit.
I have trouble keeping my horse fit. Guess I just need to work him harder. Well, we looked at some Frisians in the Netherlands. There were 66 horses from six different sires, so 11 horses approximately apiece from these sires. And they went through the stud book evaluation, a 7-week training regime. Horses were trained 5 days a week and 2 days on walkers. They also had some carriage training associated with this, as well as some lunging. So it was pretty much a standardized type program. They had an exercise test pre and post training regime. They looked at cardiac activity. They looked at lactate levels. They looked at other blood levels, other parameters there. The response to this exercise test, a standard test that they had. And what we had was that the stallion, at least in this, looking at the sire side of things, that the offspring of some of those stallions improved significantly more than the offspring of others. And to such an extent that some of the progeny from some of the sires had almost little or no change in the fitness. So these horses, they went through this whole program and weren't any fitter at the end than they were at the beginning, whereas others, you know, were changed dramatically. I was unaware of this, but there was a similar correlation in humans, that there are some humans that will develop fitness this way and go through an exercise program and develop fitness, and that same person right next to them can do the same thing, and, you know, nothing happens. So is it a matter of what needs to stimulate that fitness level? What type of work do you need? Or is it a matter of, is there some genetic aspect that is associated with that? The question was, is there a genetic marker that may be able to look at this? I think gene identification is going to be a huge thing, and it's coming along, you know, now that we have the genome of the horse identified. Interesting, we're doing a study, sort of a multi-centered study, Michigan State's part of it, but they're looking at roarers in horses, and it looks like it's linked to height, which is an unusual thing. And the two genes are very close, and it's their height at a yearling age. They've looked at something like 800 thoroughbreds, and we're actually looking at draft horses, believe it or not. Draft horses have a very high incident of roaring or laryngeal paralysis. But in the draft horse, you can actually separate out the two genes for height and laryngeal control. Whereas in thoroughbreds, they're so closely tied that it's very difficult to separate them out. This is all lab work stuff. This is really bench science stuff that I know nothing about. This is what I've been told. And so we're looking at all sorts of familiar aspects, different families of draft horses and different breeds of draft horses. And actually the Belgians had the widest variation, so you can separate out those genes. So we're looking for all sorts of Belgian draft horses to get samples from, scoping them. Michigan has a lot of draft horses I was unaware of. They're looking at that, looking at the Belgians especially, and trying to separate those things out. And I think, again, that's sort of the wave of the future, that we probably won't be around to be able to say, take a blood sample and look at the genes and say, I want one that jumps well, I want one that, you know, stays fit, I want, you know, this or that, and be able to make that assessment just out of blood sample. It's been a long time since we worked on those movements. We'll have to start from scratch and refresh and get back in the groove to do that. So we're looking a little bit at long-term memory on horses. And there were some French researchers from an agricultural station there, looked at 26 horses were tested on tasks that they had learned 2 years ago. And they had been trained on these tasks for a few minutes a day for basically 2 weeks. You know, where 15 days came from, I don't know. 2 weeks would have been easier, I think. But for 15 days. And basically there were these two tests, back up after being told to back, and they got a treat. Like I said, food's a great motivator. It's always been for me. And then to cross an obstacle after hearing a bell ring. And the reward was that you didn't get a puff of air. So they turned on a blower and sort of made the horse uncomfortable. And then the horse had to get away from that. You know, everything with horses is reward and punishment. I don't care how you talk about training or riding, it's reward and punishment, and it's just how you give it. But in this test, you know, these were the two things. And then none of these horses had been trained to refresh on those tasks or go over those tasks for 2 years. And these researchers went back to this group of horses and said, I wonder what they'll do. And they all retained it perfectly. Those horses knew exactly what they had to do. And their study was based on a study that suggested that horses can have a long-term memory up to 10 years. But that study only had 3 horses in it. So they were concerned that maybe there weren't enough horses, or those horses were brilliant in some way. You know, as my horse is brilliant. And so it was interesting. And I think most people have heard that it takes a certain number of times of good repetition to embed something. And that's been shown in a number of studies, and the number is usually around 7. So you better do things 7 times right, and then they get it. You know, kids too. And for riders, what's that mean? Yeah, puts the emphasis on us, doesn't it? Yeah, don't make too many mistakes. Well, geez, I do make them every time I throw a leg over the saddle, you know, that's for sure. But it really does, you know, well, I'm going to practice that. Well, you're practicing your horse too, you know, at the same time. It's easy to train those bad habits, and that's why it makes them hard to fix too. So it keeps coming back to us as owners or riders, doesn't it?
And next, Dr. Peters offers advice on PRP, regenerative therapies.
That is a talk within itself. But I think the bottom line there is, you know, there are a number of people all over the world working on these things. And it again, is a hot topic and a lot of great things. I mean, you know, the whole idea is that the horse's own therapy or own mechanisms can do the job and enhance the healing process, I think is wonderful if we can do it without having to use some other medications or some synthetics into an injury and things like that. And the whole idea is to get a more normal, functional tissue at the end. Well, you learned here a little bit that tendon doesn't necessarily get better, it gets worse, and ligaments get worse, and joints get worse. So what we're trying to do is heal it to the best we can at that particular stage. And you know, there are pros and cons, and there are studies that show benefits and others that don't. I think the other important point is it generally doesn't shorten the time, you know, involved with any injury. Most people that say, oh, I'm going to use PRP because I'm going to, you know, be able to ride that horse in 4 months rather than 6 months, you know, that isn't what it's for. But I think it's got a lot of potential to it. And the other thing about it is that I think it forces us to do a better job with rehabilitation because we end up investing a lot more to do it. So we're more willing to do the rehab, the aftercare, the management that's involved. And I think in the past we've done a lot of this, well, let's get them out of our sight for 3 months and turn them out, and we've been able to do that. We really need to see, you know, how well tendons heal just by throwing a horse out for 6 months. Well, we used to do that. We used to be able to do that. It was economically feasible. People had space to do that. The investment in the horses isn't what it is now, both emotionally and monetarily, and all those things have changed the playing field where we all want to be involved and we want to do what's best for the horse. They've got great potential, but I think we need to use them well, and we need to try to determine what things are best for what injury. Are stem cells better for this particular tendon injury or this ligament injury, or should we use PRP for this, or should we use IRAP for this joint? I was talking to a veterinarian. He just used IRAP as an epidural in the epidural space in a horse for chronic back pain, and the horse responded great. You know, and you can inject it in the epidural space along the spinal cord from the tail, and that horse is doing fantastic. So, you know, what types of things can we use it for? How effective can it be? I think there's a lot that we don't know about it, but it's a whole talk of 2 hours within itself. But, you know, talk to your veterinarian, and if you have a problem, or, you know, most vets are well aware of it now, are willing to use it, try it. There's no guarantee with it, unfortunately. But I think the biggest thing is it, because they aren't cheap for the most part, that we tend to get more invested with the fact that we have to do all the aftercare and all the management afterward. If we did that initially with an injury, would we have the same result? That's the question. And I can tell you, I've been fooled both ways. You know, I had a lady come in with an endurance horse. I had a very nice tear in a superficial digital flexor tendon. Perfect to put some PRP in there, follow it up maybe with, you know, some cultured stem cells. We talked and we went through everything they could do, and she said, well, I've got a nice little pasture, you know, we can, I'll keep them confined, do some physical therapy with them for a month, then I'll turn them out. I said, well, okay, great. I think that's wonderful. You know, that was one of the things we talked about. And she brought him back 6 months later, and that thing looked terrific. And 2 months after that, she was doing 25-mile competitive rides on him. She sent me a picture of him being winning a 100-mile race essentially a year after the injury. And the other thing is that no two injuries are the same. There's no way you can compare apples to apples. It's almost impossible. And we've got all sorts of models of using collagenase to try to make tendon injuries, things like that, but those are not the real thing. And those are not all the same, no matter how you do it. So we were talking a little bit about tendon work. The guy at our school there, he's got a mechanical model for tendon injury that really profiles the horse, but he's doing it in rat tail tendons. Well, someone can certainly argue that you know, it's not the same thing, but it's but the rat tail tendon with mechanical stress will show the same injury that we see in horses with mechanical stress injury. So it's interesting. Question up here: what's the best way, in my opinion, to prevent leg injuries in the sport horse? Okay, not ride them, not ask them to do anything. Have them as a pasture pet, and they'll still get a leg injury. A little more serious, I think a lot of it comes down to management in terms of consistency. There was a question about fitness and development. You know, I think that has a big factor. All these ancillary things, shoeing, footing, all these things all play a role. Almost anything does. I think we tend to emphasize some things more than others. I think any horse needs to be cross-training. A dressage horse, I believe, is the worst thing for them is to be in a ring every time they work. And we get it all the time, or I get it all the time. My horse went to a show and he didn't perform as well. And I happened to know where that horse came from, and he never left the ring at home. And they said, our footing is perfect, it's beautiful. That's the problem. Your horse can't adjust when he goes somewhere, and all of a sudden he's got a pee in his shoe, you know, a pee under the mattress. They can't handle it. I think horses need to be out. I need all those proprioceptive type things. The vibration plate, I think what that does is it probably stimulates all those little proprioceptive nerves and all those little movements, and those things are as important as anything. But, you know, a horse is different in the ring versus just trotting around a grass field, and we've gotten away from that. And again, it's because we have so much invested in them, we're worried about them getting hurt. And I'm on a soapbox now, watch out. I think we've gone ahead and we're treating them too kindly in a ways in terms of their workload. Most people think they work their horses hard, you know? They spend more time tacking them up and untacking them than they actually ride them. And when they ride them, half the time they're talking to their friends, and the other half they're on the phone. And then they get, you know, into, well, let's do a little high intensity, short duration work, and we're both exhausted, we're sweating, and, you know, let's go back in. I think these horses need to have more variation, and I think they need to, in most cases, need to work harder than what they are.
And finally, Dr. Peters answers the question as to whether thin-soled horses can be helped.
I think there are things you can do. You can put some sole tougheners on them. I think that's good. There are some feed supplements that certainly anecdotal, you know, get better hoof growth. I think one of the biggest things, so here we go again, is that we want to make the feet look good, our farrier industry. And I shoe my own horses. So I'm one of them that, you know, is right there. but horses, you know, are getting shod 3.5 week intervals. This is ridiculous. 3.5 to 5 weeks. Most horses can go more than 5 weeks. And part of the problem, though, is we're also washing them twice a day. You know, no one uses a brush anymore. They don't curry them. That's part of getting them warmed up and getting them supple. And, you know, we don't do as much of that as we used to. We don't do rub rags. How many people use a good rub rag and slap on them? And, you know, there's a cheap muscle stimulator right there. No $35,000 MagnaWave there. But getting back to your feet, I think, yeah, we have to be careful. A lot of farriers now are using the drill sanding blocks. You know, they used to have just a hand sanding box, and they'd sort of touch them up and finish them now. Now they've got the drills with the round ones, and they're taking off the periopal off the horse's foot, so it looks good for the owners. You know, it's a nice picture, and they paint something on there, and that wears off in 2 days, whereas the natural periopal, it's Mother Nature put it there for a reason, I hate to tell you. I think we're doing that. We're also taking a lot of the callus away from their foot, and we're taking away that, especially at the toe. And so I think a lot of horses get sore, not necessarily on their whole sole, but because we take away that callus at the toe, that's where they primarily will get that soreness, and it sort of radiates through the foot. Some of the pour-ins I think are good, but in some cases those will actually cause more pressure based on what you're working on. And so a horse will work great at home. Someone takes the pour-in to a sand arena at a show, and all of a sudden their horse is tender-footed, it won't extend, and they wonder why that won't extend. So I think a lot of what we do, we have to really, you know, sometimes step back and just take a look and say, you know, what are we accomplishing? Where do we want to go? You know, how much involvement do we have? Sometimes no involvement is the best part. Don't fix it. You know, sometimes, you know, some of those thin-soled horses, you know, they need to toughen up. I mean, unfortunately, that's the case. I've had some horses that have chronic sore feet. You know, the owner said, oh, my God, I can't deal with this. And I said, well, just, you know, give them 6 weeks. Don't mess with them. Just, you know, give them 6 weeks and let him grow his foot out and sort of let things quiet down instead of trying to, you know, keep this whole cycle going. Because it's again, one of the things like back pain. A horse gets into the sore feet, you've got to break that cycle some way. You know, and sometimes it's protection, you can do it. Sometimes it doesn't work. And then you have to go back and try something else.
This series of Mythbusters with Dr. Duncan Peters was taken from an education session at the 2013 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. The 2014 Adequan USDF Annual Convention will be held on December 3rd through the 6th in Cambridge, Massachusetts. This podcast is available on iTunes and at usdf.podbean.com. Visit eTrack, the USDF's online learning center and resource for dressage and equine education. For more information at usdf.org. The USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.